Good afternoon. Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water for Thursday, May 21st, winding down the clock here on official committee activities. I will open up a public hearing on SCR 5 and invite Senator Atkinson and anyone he wants to bring up or not to tell us about this resolution.
Thank you for the Mr. Chair. For the record, I am State Senator Jason Atkinson. I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon. This is a simple SCR, and it was designed actually for two reasons. One is the memorial of someone that was very important to my family and to a tremendous amount of people in Southern Oregon. And secondly, as a document to memorialize him that in the lodge that is at Mount Ashland, which is the purpose of getting all this done on nice paper and having all of us moving on. Very quickly, Gene Landsman is somebody who was an absolutely extraordinary individual. He was a consummate gentleman in the classical sense of the word. He was on the Austrian national ski team for many years before moving to Sun Valley and then later to this fledgling brand new ski area that has now become Mount Ashland. He was a man of all traits who actually lived in the lodge for some time. He never married, but he took on a tremendous amount of kids for generations as his own, and I being one of them. And so my brother and I can't think of anybody in our world that grew up in Ashland in that particular sport who did not have the same affection for Gene Landsman. Gene went on throughout his career to compete as an American when he became an American and compete on various levels all the way up until the year that he died in Masters Nationals. At the very height of my ski career, I had a hard time beating Mr. Landsman. And he, as you can see, he was an extremely generous with his time and with his talent. What this simply does is this commemorates his life. It also commemorates the whole community that is Mount Ashland. And I say that actually very specifically because it was the whole community that got behind the saving of the mountain when the mountain was owned by Stevens Pass in Washington and threatened to shut down the mountain and remove all the chairlifts. It was Gene Landsman and a few other community leaders who rallied and actually had the city purchase the ski area, something that has not been done before or since. It's a terrific resolution, and it is at the request, if you look, of my little brother. And I would be delighted if you would pass this on and allow us to commemorate him with some nice parchment paper and a nice frame and a nice little story to put a capstone on a memorial to him at Mount Ashland. And so every time each of you visit and spend all of your tourist dollars there, you can take pride in a piece of artwork that is hung on the wall signifying someone who is very instrumental in keeping that alive and letting generations of kids ski really fast. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions, Representative Boone?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Atkinson, do you guys sponsor an annual race, like a downhill, to honor him?
There was several. See, the problem with Gino, as he was called, is he was too fast. And so we would never, all the races that were there, we would never let him race in. We would let him forerun, which is to check the timing equipment. And my little brother, who is still a full-time coach there, several years ago they had state high school championships there, which Gene was the forerunner for, and destroyed everybody. I mean, kids that eventually went on to the United States ski team, the United States B team, or the various PNSA teams still could not beat this guy. There was several key races down there. One was called the Bud Cup. that, as we've talked about, renaming it in his honor. Another was, actually, he was a marketing director for a while, and as you know, Ashland has got a tremendous amount of great chefs. He actually came up with a chef's race where people had to wear an apron, a chef's hat, and carry a ladle in at least one hand and do a race, and he won that too. So I was always kind of, he was kind of a sandbagger because he'd create races to beat people, but there has been the thought of doing something like that for him. He was really a sweet guy, and he never lost his accent either, which made him very endearing. He could, if you're ever late and your mom was mad at you for being late to the parking lot, he was the guy you wanted to have, you know, get you off the hook with that accent.
Yeah, follow up too. Where in Austria was he from? Yeah.
I could find it on a map, but I cannot say it.
Representative Boone, I noticed in here he was born in Tyrol, Austria, and having personally spent a little bit of time in that part of southern Austria, I can understand the appeal that southern Oregon might have had for him, both for its skiing, also for its sort of rugged scenery, and it's a beautiful area.
Yeah, he was an amazing guy, and I usually don't do too many of these, but this one was special. I cannot tell you the amount of, in my ski career lasted professionally 9 years, and from people that were faster than me to people that were not as fast as me, we all had the same affection for this guy, and now that I'm a senator on a cane occasionally, this is the only way I can ski right now, and I'm very glad to have this. So
thanks for bringing it forward, Representative.
A final. We have a note floating up here. It said he would have trouble beating the downhill queen of Alpental.
Who says this? What?
We don't know.
We don't know.
I think it's a challenge.
Is that a cheap shot at the upper at the Senate at me? Is that what that is? Because I'll race you.
You're right.
I'm on the would be with one leg. I had some of these made up, and I'll perhaps Sue, you can pass this around. Couple shots of that was his last race actually.
So,
and my little
I'm
brother
really
my little brother
this.
Took that, so
I'm really glad you did this there. In all seriousness, too often there are unsung heroes, and he sounds like he was one.
Yeah, really a sweet really had a sweet disposition about him.
Thanks very much, Senator.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on SCR 5 and open a work session on SCR 5.
That's the sweet side. Right?
And Representative Gilliam?
Yes. I'd like to make a motion, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
You may.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 5 after that wonderful presentation to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation.
Representative Gilliam moves SCR 5 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not know Gino, and I got in here a little late, so I missed part of the presentation. But I started skiing myself in my mid-30s. No one would ever accuse me of being a racer. But I did learn enough about what ski areas are like to know that every ski area that is worth its salt has one or two very important characters. They're small communities. They're very small communities, except on Saturday and Sunday when the whole town comes, of course, or the whole valley. But otherwise, they're very small communities, and everyone knows everyone else, and there are a few people that hold these things together. It sounds like Gino was one of those people for Ashland, for Mount Ashland. And I'm very pleased to support this resolution.
Thank you for those comments, Representative. Seeing nothing further, Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Excuse?
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Buckley's name is on the bill. I haven't talked to him about it, but I expect he would be happy to carry it. And with that, I will close a work session on SCR 5. Let's do this, committee. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 76A. We're not prepared to move this bill forward today, but we are prepared to entertain the Dash 14 amendments. These were consensus amendments that came sort of just as the Senate was winding up its work on the bill. We'll need the fiscal to go along with them, but we can adopt them into the bill. But to hear about them, we were told about them at our initial public hearing. But Mr. Carrier, would you, maybe Mr. Bolton, or Civic Corps representative, and Mr. Bissonnette, come on up and just remind us what the Dash 14s are meant to do.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to have Paul Graham from the Department of Justice, who helped draft those amendments,
sure,
describe them.
Yep. Go ahead.
Paul Graham, Oregon Department of Justice. Let me begin by reminding everyone again that the Department of Justice has no position on the bill. I did draft the amendments along with Andrea Kelly and then an ICNU representative also worked with us on the amendments. The amendments are designed to flesh out what is covered and not covered by dam removal costs. ICNU was concerned that there was no definition in the bill of dam removal costs, so Michael Early from ICNU brought that message to Andrea Kelly and me and to Pacific Corps and to the governor's office, and then we created some amendments, and ICNU, that is ICNU, agreed to the amendments. The amendments are now contained in the Dash 14s.
Thank you. Scott?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott Bolton for Pacific Corp. Just to echo Mr. Graham's discussion of how the amendment came together, it is what we believe a carefully negotiated and consensus amendment among Pacific Corp, the Klamath SB 76 proponents, and our industrial customer group representatives, as well as the Farm Bureau, who also raised questions and concerns about what exactly were the costs that were covered by the cost cap contained within Senate Bill 76. So we believe this amendment provides further clarity, adds more certainty to our customers as well as the PUC as they consider what costs can be passed to our customers.
Very good. Are there any questions? I don't know if Jeff is in the room. Looks like he's not. Any questions for these gentlemen on the Dash 14 amendments? Seeing none, I'd take a motion on the Dash 14 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 14 amendments to Senate Bill 76A.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 14 amendments to Senate Bill 76A. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection?
Mr. Chair, just saying for the record, I think that these might make it a better bill, but this is not committing anybody to say that the bill with these amendments, they're pledging a vote one way or another.
As usual, that is the case. Thanks for noting it for the record. There is no objection. The amendments are adopted. And before you step down, in particular, Scott, there's one area of concern that I know I've raised with you, or at least interest that I've raised with you, related to the question of replacement power. And go ahead and bring up anybody else who can help with this. While in the course of my sort of work through this bill, I took the opportunity to listen to your testimony from February of 2008 related to kind of ongoing conversations in the Klamath. And at the time, Pacific Corps' position was that the dams were an important part of the portfolio. I think you said, and I didn't write down quotes or anything, but I think you used the word sort of carbon-free 10 or 12 times over the course of that 6 or 8 minutes. I mean, these are hydroelectric dams. They provide carbon-free power. They allow you to firm up the renewable resources that are coming online. As we contemplate, or as this bill contemplates, doesn't commit to, but contemplates dam removal, What can PacifiCorp customers, what can Oregonians expect in terms of replacement power? I know it came up at the previous hearing, but I want a better understanding both of the costs associated with taking those megawatts out of the Klamath River, but also the carbon question related to the removal of, as you said, an important carbon-free resource in Pacific Power's portfolio.
Chairman Cannon, this is Andrea Kelly with PacifiCorp, for the record. The replacement power will be part of our integrated resource planning process, where we will identify cost-effective alternatives. We will look to keep our customers whole as far as replacing it with carbon-free power. And we will have the opportunity to plan between now and 2020, when the dams are removed, to do that in an orderly way. We've also identified the opportunity for public-private partnerships, as well as partnerships with irrigators and farmers in the basin, to identify renewable resource projects down there in the basin to replace this power. And those conversations are ongoing with the federal government and with our customers, the irrigation customers. So we're looking even today to try to replace those with renewable resources. Finally, we're working to protect our customers as part of renewable portfolio standards and any carbon legislation to make sure that our customers aren't harmed by dam removal. So we're approaching it on several different fronts. I also would take the opportunity to talk about what happens if under relicensing. Under relicensing, the generation at the facilities at J.C. Boyle, which is located in Oregon, under the terms that have been put forth by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as part of the relicensing, we would lose over 40% of our generation capability at J.C. Boyle if those were imposed as part of relicensing. So we have replacement power risks in any event. This allows us to plan more orderly and go through 2020 to replace that power. Under relicensing, we could lose 40% of the generation in a couple of years.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take the opportunity when we're talking about this to reiterate my commitment to the hydrogen hub concept with the help of the real vice chair and Representative Bailey. We've got a bill through the House and hopefully through the Senate. And PacifiCorp is aware of this and have been a supportive partner. But I think this could be a wonderful opportunity to showcase what we can do with hydrogen hubs because of what you just said. You're going to have time to start looking for ways to supplement that power. And hydrogen hubs in Oregon could be an excellent way to do that. And I just want to be sure that we remember that as part of the strategy in Southern Oregon. Thank you.
That's a good point, Representative Gilliam, in that having that 10-year planning horizon is going to allow a lot of time for some of the nascent technologies that we're seeing today, wave energy, hydrogen hubs, some of these technologies that aren't quite yet commercially available or cost-effective, by 2020 may be a much more viable resource and may be more appropriately placed as a replacement resource in the Klamath Basin.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. How many megawatts are we talking about? Do we know?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bernhardt, the four dams on the Klamath, the total Klamath hydro project is rated at 168, 171 megawatts total capacity, right in that range. Currently, the project produces about 80 average megawatts of power. And so
160 peak, 80 normal.
Well, yeah, the total capability, representative, of if we had lots of water and lots of time would be about 170 megawatts total. But okay. On average, we're annually looking at about 80 megawatts of production coming from those facilities.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful in understanding the magnitude of the problem that we're talking about.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Do we have any update?
on the bond issue ballot initiative in California. When is that up? I'd heard rumor before that it was going to be up this last Tuesday. I got an email that said that didn't pass. I thought that meant it failed. It turns out it wasn't up, which is very different. Do we have any update on that?
Representative Smith, the California legislature is currently writing the enabling legislation. We expect that legislation to be finalized, or at least in a shape to be presented for next year. I think it's much more realistic time frame to craft the overall water bond package. Remember, I think the plan in California isn't to just bond for the Klamath Dam removal commitment that California signed up to, the $250 million. They'll be part of a much, much larger bonding issue that deals with Central California water storage issues and other restoration projects in the state. So it'll be a much bigger package. They're still working through that this legislative session. I think most California legislative observers, including us, believe that they'll probably go out for a vote to the people sometime in 2010, either in their May elections or in November.
Do we have a couple follow-ups? Do we have any indication of, so if your liability is capped, your ratepayers' liability is capped at $200 million,
and if there is allowance in the AIP above $450 million, is there anything in the statute or in the AIP that would shield Oregon's liability if California, for whatever reason, between now and some time in 2010, doesn't cover that $250 million delta? And then related to that, anything that does, you know, and then if it goes north of 450, I think I sort of have an answer, but do we know anything about that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think one thing to clarify in your question is that there right now, as currently anticipated from the AIP, there is not a contingency for costs above $450 million. So should removal cost more than $450 million, there will be a consultation opportunity between the signatory parties to figure out if it is indeed cost-effective to move forward. I guess as far as total limits of Oregon's liability, that's what you have before you right now in Senate Bill 76. It is a total cost cap for Oregon cost liability of $200 million.
Wait a minute. I want to stop there. What I think we have is a cap to Pacific Core ratepayers, but I don't think we have is a cap to Oregon liability. In fact, I have it here written all over it. I understand that nothing in Senate Bill 76 would impose liability on the state for such claims. That's good news, but I have seen nothing beyond the cap of Pacific Core ratepayers that would cap Oregon's liability over either $200 million or over $450 million. I'm exploring, maybe they've already been submitted, amendments. I don't know what the appetite for those will be, but it does seem, I'm not wrong, right? I mean, when we're saying we're just going to cap Oregon liability, what you mean is we're going to cap Pacific Core ratepayers' liability, right?
Do you want to take that, Andrew?
Representative Smith, the Oregon customers of Pacific Corp, their liability is capped at $200 million. As far as the Oregon liability in excess of that, I think the perspective that we need to keep in mind is that the greatest liability that folks have identified as part of dam removal is around the sediment. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the sediment behind J.C. Boyle in Oregon is less than 10% of the overall identified sediment in the project. The vast majority of the sediment sits behind COPCO 1 and Iron Gate, mostly due to the fact of the order in which they were constructed and the mobility of sediment upstream. So when we looked at the different estimates for sediment removal, the removal of sediment, if it's necessary in Oregon, is estimated to be between $5 and $7 million. Behind COPCO 1 and Iron Gate, then you're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think that protects Oregon from what has been identified as the largest liability, because there just isn't a lot of sediment that sits within Oregon.
Thanks. I'll just do one more.
Yeah.
I appreciate the folks who visited me in my office, and you know, one of you is at the dais now, and appreciate your time and did read the opinion. And I'm not I don't think I'm some fancy pants that's figured this out and everybody else is confused. That's not my impression. But from what I know, what I understand is there's a cap on ratepayer liability of $200 million. But if California doesn't come through, if we're wrong, and I think we're probably right, right? I mean, everybody looked at this is way smarter than I am. I think we're probably right that it's going to be cheaper to remove the dams than relicense. I think we're probably right the environmental benefits of removing the dams are better than relicensing. I'm just, the question I've got is, what's the contingency for probably? And I understand the contingency for probably for Pacific Core ratepayers. But there are citizens of the state, even Pacific Core ratepayers, who aren't just Pacific Core ratepayers, but also taxpayers and also people who live around the state. So what I want to make sure, in case I'm missing something, and it's not rhetorical, but how I started this was, is there any contingency if California doesn't come through? Like, if California doesn't come through with their 250 to get us to the 450, what do we do then? We're crossing our fingers. It's not going to go over $200 million. Yeah. Is there contingency there? Maybe I missed that. And then I think I've got the answer at over $400-$450 million. We'll have a conversation. Maybe something will happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm obviously still hopeful that there might be a chance for the legislature to revisit this, if as we learn more as the dams happen, or that there is not only an opinion that tells us that there's nothing in the bill that imposes liability. And not only that there is something that there is nothing that suggests that Oregon would be required to pay any money, but in fact that we know who would have to pay that money, because otherwise, otherwise then it's Oregon or it just stays there. And I'm with you; it's probably better. It probably isn't going to happen. But I want to have a contingency on probably, because I'm not a fiduciary for Pacific Core ratepayers. To some degree, I am, but I'm a fiduciary to those other folks who 10 years from now are going to be sure as hell hoping this is a good deal.
Representative Smith, if California doesn't come up with their part of the bargain, this deal does not go forward.
That's helpful, thank you.
And if the federal government does not arrange for a dam removal entity or in some way assume the transfer and ownership for removal of the assets, the deal does not go forward.
Thanks.
So those are the cornerstones of the agreement.
Good.
And how Oregon has negotiated an arrangement that protects state taxpayers as well as the Oregon customers of Pacific Power in this deal.
Good. Thanks very much.
Is there anything further for these folks? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on that line of questions because it's interesting. So if California comes up with the money, and the money that you're talking about is the money for the dam removal, is there a cap also on their ratepayers' liability? Did I read that in there?
Representative Benz, yes. They would pay, the customers of Pacific Power in California will pay they'll pay about 20% of the $200 million cap, and Oregon customers will pay 90%. Our share in Oregon is $180 million. In California, it's approximately $20 million. Then, above and beyond that, California will issue a bond for up to $250 million, above and beyond that for the total of $450
million. Right. And to follow up on Representative Smith's questioning, I think the issue was, if the cost was greater than that, who would be responsible? And your thinking is that it wouldn't be our problem because the sediment is not in Oregon. Thus, it would be somebody else that's responsible, not us. Just to follow through on that thinking, it appears that the concept is this is severable. That's why one dam is called out in one place and three are called out in another. And the allocation of liability then, you have legal opinions suggesting, could be allocated to California. Is that the logic?
Representative Benz, if this dam removal is estimated by the federal government to cost more than $450 million and no entity steps up and assumes the liability in excess of that, the deal does not go forward.
What entity would step up? Where is this? Is it that people think... Well, what entity is going to step up?
None has been identified at this point in time, which would lead one to conclude that if it is going to cost in excess of $450 million, that we would find Pacific Corp back heading down a relicensing path.
Thank you.
Is there anything further?
I just want to say to the people who've been working together to put this deal, in my questions, forgive me. I'm not trying to offer any disrespect, not trying to, disrupt something I know has dealt with lots of people more influential and smarter than I am on a thing that's intractable and harder than anything I'm working on. And by trying to figure it out and apply my best judgment, in no respect do I mean any derision on the hard work that's been done, but I do think I want to get to the bottom of it as best I can.
And I just want to finish up by coming back to the replacement power question. I apologize for being obstinate here, and I recognize this 140 or 80 megawatts is not a huge part of the overall PacifiCorp, six-state portfolio. But let's say that, my question is, I think, pretty simple. Let's say that PacifiCorp's current renewable portfolio, including hydroelectric projects, so carbon-free portfolio, is here today, and a renewable portfolio standard is going to require raising it by 2025 with interim timelines along the way. We're, with the removal of dams, we're bringing down the starting place by a little bit on the carbon-free side, which would appear to mean, that it also brings down the total number of renewables, unless you're going above and beyond the RPS and meeting it. And I recognize how complex this subject is. I mean, we're talking power here. We're talking the RPS. We're talking a multi-state, multi-jurisdictional kind of world. And I'm oversimplifying it. But help assure me, I'm thinking of your testimony last year, Scott, carbon-free, 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 and an important part of that PacifiCorp's portfolio. Help me feel confident that this advances our efforts at meeting the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals, doesn't set them back.
Sure, Mr. Chair. There's kind of two issues there in your question, if I can maybe take a moment to answer that. Absolutely. Hydroelectric power is carbon-free, and the loss of any carbon-free resource, especially in these uncertain times as far as what will national or even regional or state carbon reduction policies yield, is tough. And so that's not with great enthusiasm we would lose any carbon-free generation from our portfolio. I think what drives us here to this broader discussion, which is incorporated two states and now two presidential administrations of interest, is that there's a greater public interest involved in the Klamath Basin than just whether there should be a continuance of a carbon-free resource. On your point about renewable resources, just to be very clear, when the last legislative assembly passed Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, that standard does not recognize the Klamath Dams as a renewable resource for Oregon compliance purposes. So while, yes, we are indeed losing a carbon-free resource as we look at our overall carbon burden, we are not losing an Oregon-compliant renewable resource. Ironically, we are losing a California renewable resource because California's RPS does recognize small hydro. And the lower three dams located in the state of California do meet California's RPS standards, and I think this ties back to Ms. Kelly's earlier testimony that, one of PacifiCorp's great interests in not just this legislation but going forward is making sure that our customers are made whole or at least protected from, exposures by changes through public policy to our generation portfolio.
I want to confirm that I'm understanding it correctly, because I think you're saying that if we define, instead of talking about renewables, which is what we did last session, and we defined them relatively narrowly not to include, old dams, but if we're talking about carbon-related resources, I think what you're saying is that when we remove these dams, we do reduce the number of carbon-free megawatts, if I can make up such a term, that PacifiCorp will have in its portfolio 15 years from now.
I think that's an accurate assessment. And I think, more and more as we look at load growth, as we look at opportunities to update our portfolio and add incremental new resources, there will be a premium on carbon-free resources, and that will be, a preference, but of course, you know, cost is also going to be a factor, and other operational qualities. So, you know, the company will have some challenges, I think, over time to figure out the best fit for replacing the Klamath resource. However, Senate Bill 76, again, gives us the opportunity to have a long-term planning horizon to be able to meet that in a more rational, systematic way than we would otherwise have under a relicensing scenario. And that's one of the customer benefits built into this legislation.
Thanks very much. Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I just want to follow up. My last question had been, what happens if the cost exceeded $450? And I want to make sure I understand the answer. I was just looking at the signature copy of the agreement in principle, page 9, and it says that the final agreement shall resolve how to provide for further funding of costs in excess of the state cost cap if, during the process of facilities removal, it becomes reasonably apparent that the actual facility costs are likely to exceed $450 million or, in fact, do exceed that amount. Am I reading this correctly to understand that the process would start, and we would then see how much it cost? And if it then costs more than $450 million, we would then try to figure out who's responsible. Is that what that says?
I can take a shot at that. Representative Benz, I think what that says is that if we start this process and it's estimated that it'll cost more than $450 million, that the signatory parties will consult and decide if it's worth moving forward or not.
And Representative Benz, I will point you to page 6 of the signature copy that looks at the United States determination and that process. And in there, there's discussion in the final paragraph that looks at determination that the costs of facilities removal are likely to exceed the if the United States determines that the cost of facilities removal are likely to exceed the $450 million non-federal contributions, then the United States will not proceed to remove the facilities unless the parties reach a subsequent written agreement on the matter. And so in the first instance, there will be an estimate of the cost done by the federal government as part of the decision to proceed. The second area where you're focusing on page 9, you know, it tries to deal with the potential chance that we could estimate that they don't exceed, the federal government could estimate that they don't exceed $450 million, but during the process, that estimate ends up to be incorrect. And at that point in time, again, the parties would meet and confer and decide whether to continue on with the dam removal process.
Philip.
Now this, I know this is a difficult matter. I know, to repeat Representative Smith's remarks, thrashing around in agreement of this quality is dangerous. But we do need to hear, I need to hear clearly, a statement of who pays in the event that the estimates are wrong, we start the project and it exceeds $450 million. And if the answer is that has to be agreed to at that time, and that would mean we're still at risk. Notwithstanding the incredible efforts that have been made in this agreement to try to rely upon the very best studies in advance, but isn't it true that you won't really know what those costs are going to be until you start?
Representative Benz, it is true that you won't know the actual costs until they're incurred. At the same time, one of the protections for Oregon is that the J.C. Boyle Dam is designed to be the last dam that's removed. So if the costs ultimately are believed to exceed more than $450 million, we will know that. And likely, if nobody is willing to step up and fund additional costs, the dams won't be removed.
And just to add a point on that, Representative Benz, the J.C. Boyle facility in Oregon represents about two-thirds, maybe a little bit more, of the total production of the facility. So if you look at the value of each structure, as far as the amount of generation it provides, the biggest dam is the last out, no matter what. And so there could still be a scenario where value is retained for the system and for our customers.
Oh,
you're right. I Haley, if someone could just say Oregon and its taxpayers are not going to be subject to cost in excess of $200 million, I can drop this. I just need to hear it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mike Carrier, Governor Kulongoski, Natural Resources Policy Director. Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I think the language in Section 9 actually addresses both yours and Representative Smith's questions. It says the final agreement shall describe how this will be addressed. So the issue of who carries the financial liability forward will be addressed well in advance. It will be addressed this summer when we complete the final agreement. And the terms of that will be clearly expressed. Further in that language that was pointed out on page 9, it expressly says that the United States, California, Oregon, the company and the company's customers do not accept liability for the cost in excess of $450 million for facilities removal. So the challenge is, as we craft the final agreement, to describe the process. If we get, you know, to the Secretary's determination and we've determined that the cost, the best estimate of the cost in 2012 is $450 million or less, we proceed, we get to the removal of the dams and find out at Dam 3 we've suddenly encountered something that's going to exceed the $450. We have already reached an agreement in 2009 as to how we will address that. That could include a commitment on the federal government's part to absorb that additional cost. It could include an agreement to, as was described, to suspend removal and go back to relicensing for the remaining dam that hasn't been removed. It could include any number of options, but it will be clear and it will be transparent in the final agreement well before we start down the road.
Follow up. I thank you for that, and I just would want to note that there were five words you left off of the, when you read that sentence, and it says absent specific subsequent agreement. So there is no hold harmless provision in this document. There is merely an agreement to agree, which is no agreement, until it is done this summer. So we won't know until this summer how that excess liability, if any, would be managed. But I don't want to understate the quality of the agreement or the care that's been put into the thinking of it. I appreciate it. It's good. It's just that I want to hear you guys' best opinion as to the degree of risk we still face. And I guess I'm hearing we don't know yet. We won't know until you've negotiated it in this agreement this summer. You've refined it. We have fallback positions, but we won't know until you've finally negotiated this remote risk of excess cost this summer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that's generally correct, although we expressly established the 2012 Secretary's determination and all the work that will go in, all the analysis and work and cost estimates included that will go into that determination, and the opportunity for all parties, and especially the states, to have an off-ramp at that time. So we will have clearly established in the final agreement what the relationship will be going forward in the event that there is some thing in 2020 when we begin to remove these dams that's contrary with our best estimates and the agreement we made. And I will say to you that as we continue to complete this agreement to protect Oregon's interest, I mean, because we're very sensitive about this issue that you and Representative Smith have raised,
We will
approach this with an abundance of caution in terms of protecting the state's interests here going forward.
Thank you.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at Section 9, is there any relevance to, this is the final agreement, may address terms, conditions, materially consistent, et cetera, including subsection E, provisions for funding any cost in excess of $450 million, should we care at all that it says may rather than will? That when I read may, I generally think, well, so might not. And maybe I'm just being picky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I had not thought about that. Let me carry that back to our attorneys that are continuing to work with the other parties to negotiate the language of the final agreement and recheck not only that may, but any other provision that expresses
other small words that I might want
such a nuanced
Hector.
Way.
All right. Thanks. And I appreciate your patience very much.
Thank you very much. I had earlier asked Jeff Bissonnette from CUB, I get a note from him saying that CUB is not lobbying on this bill. Apologies for that. And with that, I will... Representative Barnhart.
They're working on a final agreement.
Yes.
Sometime this summer. Yes?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Why aren't we doing this in February?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, part of the planks, part of the commitments within the agreement in principle that's leading up to the final agreement, one of the negotiating principles for Pacific Corp was to protect its customers' overall cost exposure. One of the critical elements to get to final agreement is to have an absolute cost cap for what liabilities our customers can be exposed to. That's one reason for Senate Bill 76. The second reason is in order to minimize the rate impact of the surcharge that will be required to build up to the approximate $180 million that is Oregon's customer commitment to get the work through the PUC to look at the agreement to establish prudency and be able to start that surcharge as soon as possible will help kind of keep down that rate impact. The more we wait, the more that cost will be between 2010, 2011 to 2020. So first, it's a condition of the final agreement to have a cost cap. Second, it's in our customers' interest to spread that cost as over as long a period as we can.
Mr.
Chair, I'd like to just supplement that response. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's anticipated that the surcharge would not commence until January of 2010. And those funds, as is expressed in the bill, will be placed in a trust account. And if not used for dam removal, say the Secretary determines that dam removal is not warranted relative to the cost, liability, and risks as compared to the benefits, then those funds are returned to the customers or otherwise used for the benefit of the customers. So the funds are protected during that period. They're not going to be spent as they're collected. And I was just concerned that your quizzical look was as, why are we even collecting these funds?
No, it's not an issue of collecting the funds. It's an issue of when the agreement's finalized. I've heard everything you said. I don't think it answers my question of why we're doing this before the agreement is done rather than afterwards.
Representative Barnhart, the impact to customers, if we can collect $180 million over 10 years, then that will require us to collect $18 million a year from customers.
Right, I understand
rate.
That part. I understood it when he said it.
If we wait 2 years for the next legislative session, then we're going to need to collect from customers $22, $23 million a year.
And I understood that, too, from his answer. I still don't understand why we have to do it now rather than after the agreement's done. You're saying that we'll collect the money over a shorter period of time. I understand that part. Is there some other reason why we need to do it now rather than after the agreement's finalized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think I can answer that. When we developed the agreement in principle and the Governor Schwarzenegger, Secretary Kemp Thorne, and President of the company signed the agreement in principle in November, we fully anticipated that well before the end of this legislative session, we would have a final agreement in place for you that would, that would inform you. We'd committed that whether or not we had that, we would start legislation in this legislative session, both in anticipation of the completion of a final agreement, as well as to soften the rate impact over time, to also meet the 2020 deadline specified in the agreement to commence removal of those dams, and more importantly, to demonstrate Oregon's commitment to this agreement to the federal government and to California so as to incent them to adopt the bond measure that California is committed to adopting and to adopt the federal legislation and the investments of federal funds into the analysis that is currently underway.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've listened carefully to the questions and comments by Representative Smith and Representative Bentz. Frankly, they've put a different picture on this bill than the ones I originally had. I appreciate the comment you just made that you were expecting to have that final agreement done by now. That makes sense to me, that we do this after the final agreement is done. It doesn't, and there's some timing issues. I have no problem as a policy matter of agreeing to what the cap that the ratepayers have to pay would be, which I think is one of the purposes of this bill. I have no problem with writing a bill that basically says Oregon isn't going to pay any of this, because that certainly would be my intention, that Oregon not pay any of this. I'm not sure we're there. And I'm listening to these certified smart people talk about it.
Let's go to Representative Jensen.
Could I wait until that?
Representative Smith.
And the last thing, you know, I'd thought we might be carrying over this bill, and the last thing I'm trying to do is, and what I'm hearing from you, I understand what you guys want the deal. I totally understand. I have huge respect for my carrier, and I want to be really understanding why you want the deal. And I heard you say we don't want to cause a crisis of confidence with a complex arrangement, and if we don't send our hostage over, they're not going to send their hostage over, and meanwhile it's not just two hostages, it's like seven hostages, and I totally get that. What would be the disaster if there were if there were some amendment that said, you know, as long as may means will, or as long as, you know, if there isn't an agreement about cost overruns above $450 million, the legislature gets to look at it again, maybe not even take a vote, but just, you know, have some sort of review. I'm wondering if there's any way to resolve this other than, you know, I'm wrong, which is totally possible, or no, this is the way it's got to be, because otherwise it's going to disrupt this whole complex hostage arrangement. And I'm sensitive to that, right? I can only imagine the challenge of trying to put something together this complex.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, and Representative Barnhart, both, I would be happy to follow up and have additional conversations about that and ways that we can create more comfort for you with regard to this bill. I just want to offer a perspective, though. I think that what has largely shaped the debate about this bill, both in the House and the Senate so far, has been a belief that this bill has a scope larger than what was intended and larger than what is necessary, because the issues that you raise are the issues that go to what we negotiate in the agreement with the federal government, California, and the company, and their terms of the contract that we reach. This bill is narrowly focused on capping whatever contribution the ratepayers of PacifiCorp make toward that agreement once it's finally achieved.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Pardon me.
I think you elevated my status to co-chair, or demoted.
I beg your pardon. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for the correction and my apologies. I would not in any way want to do that. I was merely wanting to comment that... As a former educator and someone who really always wanted to be a professional student, but it didn't pay well, and the retirement was even worse, it has been truly an uplifting experience for me to listen to these certified smart people, with their... very careful and probing into the issues here. And my thanks to you and to the folks there for this wonderful class that I have just attended. It has been very uplifting. My only good feeling out of this, the rest of it is making me feel pretty insignificant. My only good feeling was that I really, quite frankly, did kind of reach the same question that Representative Barnhart had gotten to, and the question of, where's the assurance on this regarding what's going to be after the final agreement. So I'll be anxious to hear and visit the the material that comes back to us. If I understood correctly, that you weren't planning to move this today, I think it would be very good. So. Thank you
for those comments, and a fitting way, I think, to end this. It has been interesting, went places I did not entirely expect for it to go, but I think it was helpful nonetheless. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 76 and carry that bill over to Tuesday, May 26th. Thank you very much for your endurance last hour. Members, let's move on. Actually, members, let's stand at ease for just a moment, but please don't leave. And Representative Smith, we will be right back in. Stand at ease. And we will come back to order. I want to acknowledge, before we move on, acknowledge for the record a letter from Senator Whitsett on Senate Bill 76. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 739. This is a bill we heard a week or two ago related to testing of arsenic in wells. And Gail Shibley, would you join us again? I wanted to cover one issue with you before we move to a motion. Gail, as you know, we've received a letter from someone who is concerned about this bill, and in particular the possibility that requiring arsenic testing would result in raising real concerns. She writes, this is a letter for the record from Gail Andrews, she writes that this is an emotionally missed issue and that education will be needed to help homeowners with the consequences of finding that arsenic levels exceed the standards. And I'm interested in your response to this, and in particular what the agency may do to help with this, I think, potentially very serious and important concern that we would have Oregonians who have been drinking water for years and test only to find that, my goodness, there is a real problem in their wells.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator for the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. I appreciate the question, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to address this issue. particularly as a public health professional, we're all about education and information rather than inflammation and agitation. And honestly, the business we're in very large part in this Office of Environmental Health, is providing people the information they need to keep themselves and their families safe. The issue around so I get these numbers, what do I do? As I think I've testified in front of this committee as well as in the other body, that it provides us an opportunity both at the local health department level as well as the state public health level to address this as a public health issue, not necessarily only as a groundwater monitoring issue. Very important on a macro scale, but at the individual scale, we have an opportunity then through information on our website. For example, we have a flyer, arsenic in privately owned wells. What is arsenic? How can it enter water sources? What are the health risks, etc., along with more links and for more information. Also, we have an opportunity with these kind of data to appeal to our federal funders who provide more than 80% of funding for environmental public health. And they have been, to date, very open to providing us some capacity to do health assessments and health consultations in areas that come to our attention. For example, in Sutherland Valley, we did a groundwater arsenic study that actually came to our attention through the Department of Environmental Quality. And we not only got the data from DEQ, but it allowed us to work on a very individualized basis with those homeowners, hand in glove with the Douglas County Health Department. I just want to assure this committee and everybody else who I know shares my concern that people have the information they need, that is exactly why we want to begin to share this information, these data, with the recipients, so that we can engage in a discussion and conversation identify the individual options, because those options will be different depending on what the numbers are and what the circumstances are on that particular property.
Okay. I guess I'm looking for a sort of succinct statement that the department will pursue making educational materials available to people who may find that there is, in fact, arsenic in their wells. And I'm not asking for a sort of precise commitment to what type of material that would be or what ways in which notice would be required, but at least a commitment to effort on the part of the department to put that educational material in the hands of people who test their wells. And it's an issue that I'd be very interested in following up on next year's legislative session or following. But first, if you could respond to that.
Mr. Chair, members, very succinctly, the department and public health commit to providing that kind of information that people will find helpful to them.
Okay. We'll be interested to know what form that takes and the reaction that any, testing might create on the ground, and encourage folks who are involved in that or keeping an eye on it to keep us engaged as well. If this is an issue we need to revisit, then we shall. And with that, I'd like to take a motion on Senate Bill 739.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 739A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 739A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that the level of risk that arsenic presents is just barely enough to warrant the additional cost that goes with the additional testing that's going to be required as a result of the statute. And it seems to me that the approach that you're proposing, that is, that some of that money be used for this educational purposes is one way of justifying the additional cost. So I appreciate that that exchange. It seems to me that the part of this, of course, statute says that the Department of Human Services may also by rule require additional tests for specific contaminants, and that that by rule piece is incredibly important, because that would then hopefully capture the concept you just suggested, that there be this educational effort. And then also, I'm not sure if that rule piece is going to address the need for arsenic testing, because it seems to me when we look at this map of Oregon, there are lots of areas that maybe don't have this difficulty. And it seems to me that that rule should, rulemaking activity should carve out those areas that, well, we don't need to be doing this and imposing this cost just across the board. And so that, I would hope that if I knew that that was going to happen, I would be happy to support this bill. So,
Gail, do you want to come up and talk about this language that says specific areas of public health concern? I think that may be, you know, it's the attempt to get at the limiting factor that you've described. But Gail can say more about how this might be interpreted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that is exactly right. The by rule piece is precisely to provide us the opportunity to deal with things, if you will, with a scalpel rather than, you know, a rather blunt-edged instrument. And the language area of public health concern, or whatever that specific phrase is there in the bill, was actually suggested by the realtors to get at that limiting scoping concern.
Right, and then the hope would be that we just don't have this forever cost, which is between $20 and $40, so that at some point we could begin to carve the fee back in a way that didn't just make it a cost for everybody, even though they're not at all concerned about that. That would seem to be incorrect. So if I have that as your approach in rulemaking, then I'd be happy to hear that, if that's what you're
saying. Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the language in the bill provides for the three contaminants. I want to be very clear. Those are statewide. Very honestly, I think I shared with the committee at the hearing our results from all sources that show arsenic as second only to nitrate in the number of detections, and it's just a geologic fact, and the information I think that maybe you're looking at in terms of the map is from the real estate transaction data. I could be wrong. I'm not quite sure which map you're looking at, but just to be very clear, the arsenic, nitrates, and total coliform are statewide. The other individual contaminants that may exist, that we may be concerned about, we want to be able to scope down to a very specific area. And I think I gave the example of a TCE plume outside of Kaiser, for example. And there are other variety of examples like that. There's no reason necessarily for everybody to have to deal with that. But in that particular area, we have a specific concern.
Thank you for that clarification, and I do understand what you're saying. And maybe the better way for me to suggest this approach would be in the rulemaking to establish a standard method for testing for arsenic, because maybe that would drive down the cost to those who really, in many parts of the state, apparently it may not be an issue. So is that also what you plan on doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, what I can commit to is doing what we can within rulemaking. We're not the ones charging this fee. Of course, these are private companies that determine here's what it costs us to do. So we can't exactly reach into that level by rulemaking. But within, of course, the legal constraints we've got, we are very concerned about and committed to doing this in as efficiently as a way as possible.
Thanks. Seeing no further discussion, I think we're ready for a vote on the bill. Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative
Bloom? Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Killian?
Aye.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senate Bill 739 goes to the floor. Do you want to carry it?
Consent calendar?
Consent calendar? Yeah. Help us move along quickly. Is there any objection to placing it on the consent calendar?
No objection, but a comment.
Comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no objection to that. I just want to note that the administrator gave a wonderful scalpel speech that I intend to hold her to on other bills.
Very good. No objection to the consent calendar. So moved. And with that, I'll close the work session on 739A and open a work session on Senate Bill 596A. And Beth, did you know I was going to ask you to describe the bill?
I was wondering. I thought you might.
Unpredictable.
That's right.
Keep me on your toes.
Yeah.
Mr.
Chair, members, Senate Bill 596A expands the list of brominated flame retardant chemicals that are designated in statute as hazardous substances to include, you did it because of the name of this chemical.
Yeah, there you go.
Decabrominated diphenyl ether.
Wow.
Nice.
Whoa.
Very good. All right. Well, that's the bill, and I would take a motion. Representative Bailey, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask.
Go for it.
Were you interested in entertaining or discussing the dash twos?
I was not planning to entertain or discuss the dash twos.
You can imagine my disappointment.
Representative Bailey.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 596A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 596A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I was eager to discuss the twos is because I thought it was a rather elegant solution to some discomfort folks were having by saying the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, has adopted studies, then we would move forward with the contents of this bill. And I thought that was a reasonable standard by which to go by, and I was hoping that we would.
Yeah, and I appreciate the comment, and this amendment came to my attention from the representative of the chemical companies. I actually did some work trying to understand what the effect of this would be, and it appeared that, based on my contact with NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, it was not clear that there would be necessarily studies or findings of this particular product in a way that would meet the criteria in this bill. One way or the other, either pro or against. So it didn't provide, in my view, the level of certainty that would be necessary to move forward with this type of amendment. And similarly, I think we do have certainty around the fact that DECA breaks down into its penta and octa forms. There's really no debate about that. We have already banned those forms. We know that they're dangerous, and in that for that reason, it seemed clear to me, and I think a majority of members of the committee, that this is worth moving forward at this time. Is there further discussion? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you summarized the salient points there around the constituent parts of DECA, and I have heard from some folks, and I think it's a valid point, that at some point we as a legislature need to take a comprehensive look at the regime by which we examine various chemicals and their effect on the environment. I think in this particular instance, this is a logical progression in that as we look at the subject in general of PBDEs, we have taken the first two steps. We delayed on the third step because at that time there was not an effective substitute. We now at this time realize that there are substitutes. Substitutes have been developed. Now, not all of those have had rigorous testing, but we do know that the DECA version does create chemicals that are carcinogenic and that are hazardous to human health in their decomposition. And because of that, we know that they create a problem. We know we have alternatives. We know we have time to study some of those alternatives, but that there are several kinds of alternatives. This is a logical progression from the penta and octa to the deca.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with everything that Rep. Bailey just said. And just wanted to say that that was my frustration with doing laws this way, where we just cherry-pick one chemical at a time. And I would suggest that we do move forward in a way, making policy that we can apply a different kind of scope of acceptance or not because of if something's carcinogenic or whatever. But, you know, and I was looking through the testimony that we have received on this bill and still are concerned about the burn center and the doctor there and his comments. But knowing, you know, that by banning this, the manufacturers are free to choose from a series of other chemicals which we may or may not know are as bad or worse or whatever, and that's kind of what I would like to get away from. That being said, if it is true that our federal partners are more inclined to do this broad approach from over all the whole country so we don't have this state, that state approach, I think that is a good thing. So
that's an important point. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill I would very much like to vote for. I had thought there was going to be, I'd heard rumors about an amendment, -3 amendment, that would have somehow taken into account the very point that's being raised by Representative Boone. That is, there would be some taking into account the need to prove the validity of the alternative before this happened. But I don't say that amendment. And so I'm just concerned that we are banning something without having, and I'm looking at this chart and seeing that many of the alternatives have either not been tested or have similar difficulties. So that led me to consider Washington's and Maine's approach. And then I thought, well, if we adopt this ban, what happens? Do we just make lawbreakers out of everyone in Oregon? Because it's unlikely that the tail wagging the dog, that is the tail being Washington and Oregon, is going to change lots of manufacturers' practices. And I don't particularly like that idea either. So it seemed to me we are premature, and I believe that's probably reflected in the fact that Maine and Washington have approached this. Only Maine and Washington have approached this. But, again, that's no excuse. If there's something bad out there, then we should move on it. On the other hand, we should only move on if we have a decent alternative. So that was my thinking. And so I will be a no vote in absence of that -3 amendment, the phantom -3 amendment. So
appreciate that, Representative Pence. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last comment. You know, so often when we do bills, it isn't just an either or. I appreciate Representative Bailey's comments, and I don't refute the possible danger. But it is also true, which may not be a reason not to move the bill forward, it is also true that this puts, I believe, a significant hardship on manufacturers. Yes, they may have alternatives, but the word would not be free to use them because it's very expensive and difficult for them to use them. And as you've heard me harangue before, in this particular cycle of our economy, to put more burden on business, I think, is a mistake. I think there's another way to do this. We're probably not going to do that, but I wanted to put that on the record. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've labored quite a bit with this bill. I've been unhappy with the testimony that we've received. A lot of it sounded to me like a good used car salesman. In my many lives, I've experimented with that too. But in this format, that was not the type of testimony that I was looking for. I have gone through a fairly exhaustive list of the literature. Nothing that I would want to write a paper on, and I haven't committed that much of it to memory, but there are too many questions, I think, as to the risk or lack of risk. And for reasons given by my colleagues, that maybe the cost is
of the alternatives might be too great. Maybe we're a little ahead of the curve. And I agree, too, that it's not bad to be ahead of the curve. But I want to be pretty sure of where I'm at when I do try to do that. And I, quite frankly, am not that sure at this particular point. And with some regret, I would like to have been able to vote yes on this. But with some regret, I'm not going to.
Thank you. Committee will stand at ease for a moment.
Given the discussion on the dais, it seems like there might be some possibilities with some potentially phantom amendments that we might be able to bring some other folks to a position that makes them more comfortable. And given that, I withdraw my motion.
And thank you, Representative Bailey. I do think it's possible, given this conversation, I apologize for not having opportunity to touch base with more of you before today. In an effort to try to get a dash 3 that works. We're not all the way there yet. I'm not confident in the version that we've got, but I think there may be a dash 4 that would work. So phantom dash 3s, phantom dash 4s, and I'd like to see if there's a way we can move forward with some greater degree of consensus on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Do you think it's not likely that you're going to get to 23, is it?
The 23
amendments.
I don't think we have time for that, Representative Barnhart. No, it is not.
I am pleased to hear that.
It's only in revenue, Mr. Chair, revenue.
Representative Jensen.
Yes, just a point of curiosity. Is that the chair of the Revenue Committee's record for this session? And he doesn't want it broken?
So far, I think we've only gotten to 23.
Oh. Do you
remember?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was 24.
Was it 24? Oh, we got to wait.
Maybe Representative Bailey's bill, too.
that's the subtext.
Yeah, so I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 596 to Tuesday, and with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 596, and seeing nothing further, close the committee. Thank you very much.